Welcome to Radio Islam. Assalamu alaikum and peace be with you. Good evening. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCAV 1450 AM in Chicago, Illinois, and at www.radioislam.com throughout the world. This is your host, Malik Mujahid, and it's a live call-in talk radio program airing every day 6 to 7 p.m. Central. We reach the world by streaming live at radioislam.com, where you can tap into all our prior shows as well. To add to the conversation, call us at 312-263-ISLAM. That is 312-263-ISLAM. You can also post on the Facebook page or tweet at Radio Islam USA. It's an interesting world, to say the least. There is a whole lot of things going on. Early morning, about 7 a.m., I was in a breakfast dinner of a labor movement in Chicago. There were about 700 people there. And speaker after speaker kept talking about, if they will register Muslim, I will register myself as a Muslim, including a congressperson who said the same thing. Day before, I was in Columbus, Ohio, and community was worried and concerned that an honorary student is accused of something and his professor has taken a stand, a major lawyer has taken responsibility to defend that person who has been accused of taking a car and in 1 minute injuring 11 people. But right now, when I talk about a place like Burma, where 120,000 people are without food and dying out of hunger, so much that 14 different country ambassadors in Yangoons have written a joint letter asking Burmese government to just do one thing, allow United Nations to take food there. And then we had news about Aleppo, that there are 100,000 people, and those 100,000 people are stranded, and they are dying out of hunger. No food could be reached there. And when some people try to come out, their men are being taken away by Assad regime, supported by Russia, and bombing and whatnot. And Assad and Syria has mastered the art of torture to the level that the United States, even after 9/11, took services of the Syrian government to torture some people there. It's called rendering. So one wonder what these people are looking for. Why Muslims are gone crazy? And one of the answer is they are looking for freedom, justice, and Islam, or run their life according to the way they wish. So right now, Burma is in the news somewhat. Aleppo is news all over. But there is a place far away from here which is not in the news. But two people who care for that cause deeply, who know the land and are from that area, are in our studios. So if they are struggling for freedom, justice, and human rights, these people and this name of the place is Kashmir. So today, while we pray for people in Aleppo, we also pray for people in Burma. But today we will be dedicating to talking about Kashmir. And to discuss this with us, we have two guests. And they are connected with the area. Nahid Azami. She is a senior consultant working in power industry for over 20 years. She has a bachelor's and master's degree in electrical computer engineering. Her expertise in developing custom system applications on various platforms. She serves on the executive board of the Downtown Islamic Center. She has volunteered and headed many committees at the Downtown Islamic Center. She serves as a chairperson of the charity committee of the Downtown Islamic Center. She's married and her children, and she herself is from that area. We also have in our studios in downtown Chicago, Ridwan Qadir. He is senior consultant to Fortune 100 firms in the area of strategic planning and financial management. He started his career as an investment banker and later rose to director and C-level positions, including chief operating officer, chief complying officer at an investment firm. His MBA from the University of Chicago, and he's a firm proponent of servant leadership. And there, Rizwan has served in leadership role in Islamic, Pakistani, and Kashmiri interfaith community with signature flair for passionate and analytical presentations. Well, welcome to Radio Islam, Rizwan Qadir, and Nahida Dhami. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you so much. So tell us, Nahida Dhami, first, where is Kashmir? Our audience are, you know, half Muslims who somewhat might be familiar, and half of them are neighbors of other faith. So where in the world is Kashmir?
Kashmir is up in the Himalayas on the, you know, it's...
So one side is China.
One side is China, one side is Pakistan, one side is Himachal Pradesh. And Kashmir is a valley in the Himalayas. Its total area is 85,806 square miles. And the total population, according to census, is 12,541,302.
So about 13 million people live there.
Yeah, 13 million.
All right.
And the people there speak Kashmiri, Dogri, Hindi, Punjabi, and Urdu.
Wow, they speak a lot of languages. Do they speak at the same time or a turn after turn?
No, usually Kashmir is spoken in the, you know, Kashmir Valley. And it's spoken by both Hindu and Muslims. And it has the language evolved as, it's a mixture of Sanskrit and Persian. And a lot of Arabic words, too.
All right. So when was the last time you visited Kashmir?
I think it was in 2012. Yes.
All right. So is situation right now there is better than 2012 or worse than 2012?
No, it's very worse. It's like, ever since they killed the so-called, they call him terrorist, on 6th of July, his name was Burhan Wani, and he was martyred. And actually what happens is people are, you know, fighting for their right, their freedom, and they have been promised this by United Nations Charter. And now, whoever speaks for it, they are labeled terrorist.
Okay, so this is the same story. Whoever is standing up for freedom and justice, they are just branded and a label there. So Rizwan Qadir, tell me this: this struggle is going on for a long period of time, almost 60 years. And people are making so many sacrifices. I remember about 10 years ago, if I remember correctly, at a conference in Chicago, Islamic Society of North America, at ISNA conference, there was a gentleman, I think his name was Durabi or something like that. And he was visiting here, and he casually mentioned to the audience that since he has come there, he has spoken for the rights of people. I don't know what will happen to me when I come back, go back. So I told him, why don't you stay here? Don't go back. He said, no, I have to take care of the people. I came to represent them and I'm going to go back. He went back, except that after a few months, his limbs were cut and he was thrown in the river. And that's how it dawned upon me, a person I met who really said that it is possible that I will be killed because I came here. And then we found out it actually happened. I met him right here in Chicago.
Brother Mujahid, this has been going on for almost 70 years. The Kashmir issue is one of the two issues that have plagued the Muslim Ummah for 70 years, the other one being the Palestine issue, it doesn't get into the limelight that others deservedly do, is because India typically doesn't allow journalists to go there.
Oh, journalists cannot go?
Journalists typically do not go. If it weren't for the social media, we wouldn't be hearing about a lot of things that go on. For example, remember our conversation you and I had just a few weeks ago when I mentioned that for about 5 months, the major mosque in Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir, hasn't had a Jummah prayers. Mm-hmm. You were extremely moved by that. I could sense it over the phone. So that's just a tiny factor. The journalist that you're talking about, Jaleel Andrabi, yeah, Chicago, unfortunately, was the last place.
Yeah, that was the name, Jaleel Andrabi. Was he a lawyer?
He was a journalist.
Okay.
And there have been many, many cases that we don't know about. A prominent lawyer from Racine, Wisconsin area was also murdered. And he had predicted that something might happen to him because he talked to an American writer about the atrocities there. But just to preface,
and something like that to happen again. I was giving a lecture somewhere, and I mentioned a person who was a physician in Wisconsin, a surgeon, a bone surgeon. And I was giving a speech that he's the only bone specialist there, and he's from Wisconsin, and he's serving so many people. So somebody came by the stage and put his hand on my shoulder. I say, you know, during a speech, who somebody disturbs? So I looked towards him. He said that he has been murdered.
No.
There was some from Wisconsin.
There's an American writer who had, this is the same gentleman that I'm talking about. An American writer went to Kashmir to view some of these things firsthand. And he met this surgeon in there, and he promised to put his picture on the cover of the book. Little did he know that the picture he would be putting was not of a live surgeon, but a dead surgeon. So this has been going on for 70 years, and it all started when India and Pakistan were split into different independent countries. Each state was given the right to either join India or Pakistan based on the population, and the formula worked very well for 500-plus princely states, except for four, Kashmir being the largest one, where we had a vast majority of Muslims, over 80%, but a Hindu Maharaja who, against the wishes of his people, decided to join India. And that has been the bone of contention between these two states. When we're talking about where Kashmir is located, Kashmir is the only region in the world which is surrounded by three nuclear powers. India and Pakistan have fought three wars over it, and there's always this likelihood of them going to war again over the same region. This time, the likelihood of a nuclear war is real to some extent. Personally, I do not think that the people who are in charge of India's nuclear program and Pakistan's nuclear weapons are stupid enough to engage in a nuclear warfare. But the nuclear saber-rattling does go on between these two countries.
But this happened 70 years ago. And what is the current situation which made it something which making us worried why media is not covering it again? What is the recent situation in which, give me a magnitude of what has happened in the last 6 months there?
It's not just the last 6 months. This is something that has been building for three generations. Three generations of Kashmiris have been displaced globally. Families have been broken up. Just to make it a little bit personal, my father passed away in Houston a couple of years ago at the age of 89. He has a 61-year-old sister they have never met. 61-year-old sister they had never met. That's a tiny example of how families have been broken up, how families are not able to reach each other. Members of my family have been blacklisted, so they don't communicate. They change their names when they go on Facebook, so on and so forth. And this is not unusual. What has been happening is that every generation stages an uprising, but they are crushed by the might of Indian Army that is there. And I'll talk about the magnitude of Indian Armed Forces' presence there. They are crushed, and then things calm down eventually. They give up. They try to go on with their lives because you got to live. You got to live. You got to feed your family. Then the next generation grows up. They are equally frustrated. They're frustrated by not what they're sensing, but what their fathers did, what their forefathers had to face. And then the frustration builds up. Some of them end up being militants. And this is one of the reasons we need to settle this issue peacefully so that the militants do not have any legitimacy. in terms of the presence of Indian armed forces there, get this, there are about 700,000 security forces in India. They have been there since 1958. To put it in...
Wait a minute. 700,000 Indian soldiers are in Kashmir.
That's right. Mm-hmm. In a population of 13 million. To put it in perspective, in Afghanistan, with a population of 20 million, at the height of U.S. presence, it was about 100,000. Iraq, with 40 million population, at the height of U.S. presence there, was 140,000 soldiers, American soldiers. And here we have 13 million people, 700,000, for as long as 50-plus years. Mm. There are draconian laws that give total impunity, and I'm not exaggerating, total impunity to these agencies and the security forces. They can conduct searches without warrant. They can. We talk about Patriot Act in the U.S. This is Patriot Act on steroids and have been enforced since 1950s and early 60s. So that's the level of frustration. What is very unique about the current uprising is that for once in 70 years, this is totally indigenous. No one has ever blamed anybody for this current uprising. When this militant was killed, people who oppose militancy came out in the streets. His funeral was held the very next day. 500,000 people showed up without any announcements. 43 funerals in absentia were held for him. 43 namaz-e-janaza. Ghaiban and namaz-e-janaza were held
okay,
this one person.
Our audience don't fully understand.
Funeral prayers in absentia.
Okay.
Which is a Muslim obligation, and that reflects on how strongly people feel about their youth who are, in cases like this, end up in militancy. They don't want them in militancy. This was a mechanical engineering student.
Mm-hmm.
The only time he ever engaged in warfare was on social media. He was captured and killed, and then his family was told about it.
And this, just because he was active on social media about Kashmir.
And he had also joined a militant group, so that was part of it. But why do these people fall in love with the militancy? Because they see that the politicians are not able to do anything. Pakistan hasn't been able to do much for them. And the Indian politicians have been dormant for the most part. So we have Muslim governments in Kashmir, but it's a joke. It's a puppet organization.
Also, his brother was killed a year earlier.
Whose brother?
Burhan Wani's brother.
Okay.
He was not militant. He didn't take arms, but he was in fake encounter. He was killed.
Okay, so fake encounter is another technique.
Yeah.
Are there some journalists who have exposed what is fake encounter?
They do, but nobody takes notice. And also, they have to report that no Indian military, which was deployed in Kashmir, they're not tried for any human rights violations ever since they were there. You know, it goes for rapes and, you know, using pellet guns on civilians and... You know, and we have victims like...
Yeah, tell us a little more about it. That I heard that about several hundred young children have lost their eyesight because they throw some special...
Pellet guns.
So they're not killing people this time. They're shooting them in the eye.
Yeah.
And these kids and their parents sometimes say out of exasperation that I wish they had been killed.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're ruined for life. You think that... You talked about frustration. This is where frustration builds in for generations.
And there is a case of Insha, and she was inside her house. She was fired 100 pellet guns. She lost eyesight to both her eyes, and she has some brain damage too. After staying in the hospital 3 months, now she's out, but, you know, she's
so these are pellet guns, so people are not killed necessarily, but they lose their
damage.
Eyesight and other...
Yeah, because
defaced.
It targets your soft tissues and, you know, you're done.
Hmm.
It is specifically targeted at young people because, as father, you know, there's nothing more debilitating than seeing your child suffer.
Yeah.
So why kill a 60-year-old when you can kill a 16-year-old?
Not only 16, 4-year-old. A four-year-old child, and, you know, I don't know what they get. They're too sick, you know, targeting these little kids.
So how many Kashmiris, say, in last few years have died as a result of Indian
Since 89, when the first uprising took place in recent times, over 100,000. But to put that figure in perspective, it's not just 100,000 people who have been killed. And I'm using round numbers. And these are conservative numbers. And these numbers have been are sourced from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. It's not just 100,000 people. It's 100,000 families. That's how we need to think about it. Then there have been rapes, not just women's rape, which unfortunately is a reality in most armed conflicts. But in Kashmir, there's something unique that has been done where young men were raped or sexually assaulted. Because of cultural sensitivity, they wouldn't talk about it. So you had these 25, 30, 35-year-old men who didn't want to marry because they didn't know what had happened to their bodies. And it's only now, when they're in their 50s, that they're talking about their experiences. Because of the cultural sensitivity, they couldn't talk about it. Women, when they are raped, because of the cultural sensitivity, they sometimes don't even report. So the numbers that we have are extremely conservative for rapes. And you know how big that is. Then another big phenomenon that's unique to Kashmir is enforced disappearances. Yeah. Over 10,000 people, men, have disappeared. Many of them were married. And given the faith of most of these people, the women didn't marry for years. They've been waiting. Families have been torn up. Mm-hmm. So they're called half-widows.
Half-widows. That's so what is half-widows?
A woman who has lost her husband. She doesn't know if he's alive. He was taken up by the police or the security forces, and they never heard back. Then we started discovering unmarked graves with hundreds, in some cases, thousands of bodies buried. Mm-hmm. So there have been a few unmarked graves discovered in recent times, and more are expected. And that's where these bodies are going to be. There's no agency that can do DNA testing. So there is no solace for these families. Mm-hmm. And religious ulama, our religious scholars, only in recent times have allowed these women to remarry after a certain number of years. But families are broken up. And you know how central a father figure is in these families, in our culture.
So half-widows are also about 10, 15,000.
More. Conservatively, 8,000. But as I said, that's a reported number. Mm-hmm. What about those families that don't report these things? They're too distraught over what has happened to them to report.
And they don't know whether to marry or not to marry. Mm-hmm. Or even if scholars allow them to marry, they're still wondering what happened.
Right.
And children are being raised. So if 100,000 people have been killed and 10,000 disappearances and whatnot, 110,000 families, so there got to be at least 500,000 children being raised without parent.
Mm-hmm. Orphanage is a big problem, and it's shameful. It's pathetically shameful to say for young girls who are orphaned, sometimes the only recourse they have is the oldest profession in the world. For some boys, the only recourse, the only way they can support anything, either for themselves or for their families, is to join militants. Orphanages are not allowed. This is little-known law in Indian-held Kashmir, whereby if someone who was designated a terrorist is killed in your family, your whole family is not allowed any kind of government benefit. And there is no safety net, as you know, in most of these parts of the world.
So if somebody is killed in a family and government says that he was a militant, that whole family is out of any support system.
That's correct, yeah. From the government.
Hmm. Instead of giving compensation to the person who has been killed without any due process. Are these some people go through the legal processes before government decides to kill them?
No, absolutely not. These are called extrajudicial killings. You're killed first, then ask questions later, as we Americans like to say. And this is the source of frustration. There's no legal recourse. Mm-hmm. Kashmiris have traditionally been very peaceful people. Mm-hmm. People often ask me, how come we don't know much about Kashmir? What are the reasons for this lack of awareness? Because this is not a communal issue. Kashmiris, majority of them are Muslims, have made it a great point in their deliberations that this is not a communal issue. Hindus and Muslims have lived together harmoniously for centuries. Mm-hmm. We don't want to break that apart. And they serve a great example of interfaith harmony.
You're listening to Radio Islam at WCV 1450 AM as well as www.radioislam.com. This is your host Malik Mujahid, and we are talking about Kashmir here. There are many, many flashpoints in the world. The world is not at peace, but countries sometimes claim that they are democratic countries and they are oppressing others. In this case, we're talking about Indian-held Kashmir, which has been waiting for the promises made by the United Nations and India that people can decide about their future. We have Nahid Adhemi and Rizwan Qadir in our studios. This is your host, Malik Mujahid, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Radio Islam.
Radio Islam interns don't brew coffee and fetch the mail. No, Radio Islam interns are put to work to prepare them for the real world. With hands-on learning and the world listening to their final edit, Radio Islam interns finish their semester with practical experience, giving them an edge over their competition. To apply for a spring internship with Radio Islam, send your resume to intern@soundvision.com. Application deadline is December 15th. See you in the studio.
Welcome back to Radio Islam. This is your host Malik Mujahid, and you're listening to WCV 1450 AM in the greater Chicagoland on AM and throughout the world at www.radioislam.com. With me in our studios are Nahid Adhemi and Rizwan Qadir. Both have Kashmiri heritage, and they are talking about the struggle of the people over there. And during the break, I was talking with Nahid Adhemi, and you said that you want to ask one question to the Indian government. So what's that question?
So I want to ask this question, that if they claim that Kashmir is the integral part of India, so why this inhumane treatment of humans there? Why don't they think that we're equal to Indians, you know? If they are thinking that they claim us as the integral part, why for last 5 months there were curfews imposed? Why people could not go and pray in massages?
So for 5 month curfews, Chicago has curfews every day after 10 p.m. in certain neighborhoods.
It's from morning to evening curfew.
Also,
24
it's,
hours for curfew.
It's a 24-hour curfew.
Yes.
And it's not for kids as in south side of Chicago.
No.
For everybody.
Nobody could go to jobs. Nobody could do anything.
So how people do groceries?
It's very hard. Local grocery markets, like maybe you know in Pakistan, you know how we have in the
neighborhoods. Okay. So neighborhood shop, you can go.
Yeah, that's how they could from home to home, you know.
Okay.
That's how they could do it. And it also is like, it's heartbreaking because my relative was suffering from cancer and he could not go to hospital because of that, you know.
Hmm.
There's no hospitals open. Even though hospitals are there, there's no doctors. They cannot get to there. And they cannot get to their jobs. And also, even ambulances were attacked by the army. Hmm. I mean, no one was safe there.
So your question is that if Kashmir is an integral part of India, as India claims,
yeah,
then why you're treating us like this?
Like this. And why pellet guns on little kids? Those kids were not outside. They were inside their homes. Why were they, you know, attacked with pellet guns? My question is that. And how can you have, in this time and age, a state in total shutdown for 5 months? They could not even go for Jummas. I mean, not to speak about getting groceries and getting treatment for sick people. I mean, it's hard.
So hospital is there, except doctors cannot get there. Hospitals are there, except patient cannot get out because it's a curfew.
Yes.
And if somebody is injured, the challenge is that they may get shot if they try to break the curfew.
Yeah, it's gone. Yeah. Either way, they're doomed.
Tell me this, are these questions being raised by Indians in India? I mean, do Indians know what is going on in Kashmir?
No, actually the media was cut off, you know, They were journalists tried to get into Kashmir, but they were not allowed. It was shown on social
media.
But
in this day and age, you cannot hold information down. So there are many conscientious Indians who are very vocal about it, and they're not Muslims. Arundhati Roy, for example. Then there's another Indian who has made a documentary about the sexual abuses of men. These are the contributions. A few years ago, there's a lady named Sharmila. She was on a hunger strike for 11 years. 11 years about Kashmir. So there are Indians who are raising voices, but their voices are not...
So there are some good Indians who are raising voices for Kashmiris.
Yes, at the same time...
But are they getting some mainstream media?
No, they're not getting mainstream media. It's mostly through the Western media that we find out about it. At the same time, the suicide rate among Indian Army in Kashmir is staggering. There are not enough statistics available, as you can imagine. But according to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, this is a phenomena that doesn't get talked about, and it should, because these are real people. They know what they're doing, and they're not comfortable with that.
But are there any incidents of Indian Army from Kashmir defecting and saying these things, or they just commit suicide and remain silent?
There hasn't been any known defections. Not to my knowledge.
So what is the solution? Ridwan Qadir, you're passionate about this issue, and I heard that you're organizing an exhibit in future on Kashmir in Chicagoland area. There was a solution which was agreed upon, right, between United Nations at the offer of Indian Prime Minister, and Pakistan agreed to it. So why Kashmiris don't want that solution?
There have been 23 UN resolutions from late 1940s to 1960s, and these are some of the salient features. Ironically, the first time anyone went to the United Nations was India, who approached the Security Council about this issue. The Security Council explicitly rejected India's claim that Kashmir is legally Indian territory. It's disputed territory. Then they established self-determination as the governing principle for the resolution of this dispute. It endorsed a binding agreement between India and Pakistan that a plebiscite would be held in Kashmir under peaceful conditions. That's where the caveat is. Who describes those peaceful conditions and who holds the plebiscite? The plebiscite would most probably be United Nations, but India gets to decide when it's peaceful. And India has always played into that, saying it's not peaceful to hold something
like
this.
You see, so you need to understand Indian seriousness. They have sent 700,000 army soldiers to make you peaceful so they could vote.
Right.
Would you like to have a million army people there? I mean, why Kashmiris just say, okay, we're peaceful now. We're peaceful. Just hold the referendum.
It's not for Kashmiris to say. It's for the Indian government to decide that, yes, it's peaceful, and conduct a plebiscite or a referendum. There's no hope of it ever taking place, because one absolute condition, one absolute result of that plebiscite would be that nobody wants to be with India. And Indian government wouldn't allow that.
Well, we will not know until it happens.
There is a referendum taking place in blood on the streets of Kashmir, and have been for 70 years. So that's referendum. You want referendum, sir? It is taking place when 500,000 people show up out of nowhere without any notices just to mourn the death of a young person. That's plebiscite. That's referendum. When these people come out in the streets knowing fully well that it's a curfew and they can be shot dead, but they still come out. That's referendum.
I should also point, while I was growing up, and I see all this since my childhood. Since my childhood, I've seen this, army beating innocent civilians, and I used to get nightmares, and I used to always see this guy coming after the kids, and in my dreams, and was devastating. But I should also point out here that...
So you observe what happens and it gave you nightmares.
Yeah,
about
when
that.
I was growing up. And I should also point out that the youth there, they don't have... we don't have employment there. They're unemployed. That's why probably they pick up guns because somebody is promising them something. We don't know that. I'm just saying, this is what, when I was growing up, when I graduated college, the engineers who graduated with me, they had no jobs.
So they're engineers, but they don't have any jobs.
No jobs. And then only job you could get is if you go outside, like Saudi Arabia, Dubai, this other countries, you leave your homeland. And the chief minister at that time was Dr. Farooq Abdullah. He was trying to get all these industries there, but Kashmir never saw industrial revolution. We could have had many, like chip design, this, that, because the climate was so nice for it, you know. We could have gotten those Indian companies, but India never wanted to invest in Kashmir that way because they were always saying this is disputed land. We cannot invest in Kashmir.
So they call it integral part of India. When it comes to not having the referendum, but at the same time they don't invest because they say, oh, it's a disputed land.
Right. They say this is disputed land. I mean, I know my.
So if Kashmiris themselves try to establish some industries and have some jobs, will they be stopped from doing it?
No, they're like small scale industries. Like, but how much employment can you give? You know, it's like. You know, like here, you have a mom and pop shop. Then, you know, this is only for you, or you can employ one or two people. That's it. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about industrial revolution. We never got like rest of Punjab or you know rest of India. Mm-hmm. Like in Hyderabad, they have this the huge now IT boom, and this never happened there because it doesn't mean that we don't have talented people. We have a lot of people who are educated. You know, but there's no jobs. And same goes for doctors there. And my friends who graduated with MBBS degrees, they have no jobs.
Even their physicians, they have no jobs.
Yeah. Because at that time, there was only one hospital. Then there was another one in the progress. And, you know, people used to leave. There was a big brain drain there because they used to go for Saudi Arabia and rest of other countries.
Kashmiris sometimes look across the border. One third of Kashmir is what we call Azad Kashmir, which is part of Pakistan, unofficially and officially to some extent. They look at how things have progressed there over the same period of time. So when you see your family members getting educated, living peacefully, it adds to the frustration that Kashmiris feel on the Indian health side. For example, remember the earthquake we had in Pakistan 2005?
Right.
It was also
actually
from the
it happened inside, just Radio Islam was on, and somebody called from Kashmir to say there is earthquake taking place right here. So in American media, Radio Islam was the first one to announce what was happening.
That's great history, and I've always been part of Radio Islam family in one shape or form. Very proud of that. That little affiliation we have in Chicago. It's a great institution. Now I have another reason to feel proud of it. But international aid poured in on the Pakistani side. There was no international aid on the Indian side. Similarly, there were floods in 2014 in Kashmir, but no international aid was allowed. All the great agencies we have in the U.S. that you and I support with everything and anything we can do for them, they were not allowed in India on the Indian side.
Even so, for help.
Even for help, for humanitarian help. This was flood. This was major flood.
Mm-hmm.
So are there any, you know, Muslims in America has, 50, 60 or 100 or relief organization. They're raising millions and billions of dollars. I mean, for Syria, Muslims from America in last 3 years have sent $1.3 billion. So are any of the Muslim relief organization allowed to work in Kashmir?
I know of one agency, IMRC. They were helping people there.
They are allowed to help?
Yeah.
Okay.
But not Islamic Relief, not Helping Hands, not all the major organizations that we have in the U.S., they were not allowed in because I talked to all of them in 2014 when the floods were taken.
Oh, yeah, I remember because Mr. Modi was saying, send relief to me, to President's Fund. We'll do the rest.
And did they provide any relief?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But Kashmiris are such wonderful people that when some Indian soldiers, at the height of this inaction by the Indian army to save people from, they happen to be drowning, and Kashmiri youth dove in and saved them.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one example that we know of, and I'm sure there are many examples like this. So in spite of all the animosity and everything else that they had done, they didn't let go of their basic humanity of helping a fellow human being, mm-hmm. even if he's from the army that has been oppressing you and your generations.
You're listening to Radio Islam at WCEV 1450 AM as well as www.radioislam.com. This is your host Malik Mujahid, and I'm talking with Ridwan Qadir and Sister Nahid Adami. We'll be right back after these messages.
Radio Islam now presents Marked in Time with historian Faraz Al-Khatib.
Assalamu alaikum and peace be upon you. One of the biggest stories in the news right now is the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, particularly over the Crimean Peninsula in the south of Ukraine. Both sides claim it to be theirs based on historical and ethnic ties. But one thing you'll probably miss in the news is the status of this region's original inhabitants. They're Muslims, and they are known as the Crimean Tatars. The Crimean Tatars descend from the Mongols, who in the 13th and 14th centuries controlled much of Asia and Europe. One branch of the Mongol Empire, known as the Golden Horde, settled north of the Black Sea and converted to Islam in the early 1300s. The first mosque in Crimea was built in 1314 by these Muslims. After the dissolution of the Mongol Empire by the 1400s, the Crimean Khanate emerged as a powerful Muslim state in what is now southern Ukraine and Russia. Its people mostly spoke a dialect of Turkish known as Tatar, and they were thus close with the growing Ottoman Empire to their south. The Crimean Khanate eventually became a vassal state to the Ottoman Empire and enjoyed protection and economic support from their allies to the south. But that wouldn't last long. In 1774, the Russian Empire forced the declining Ottomans to sign a treaty that forced them out of Crimea. Just 9 years later, the Russians took the opportunity to annex Crimea, beginning a long period of oppression for the Crimean Tatars. Ethnic cleansing of the Tatars was official policy, and hundreds of thousands were either forced to leave or be killed. The Soviet Union continued the policy, and by the mid-1940s, Crimea was almost entirely Russian, with its entire Muslim population exiled. In the past 20 years, however, some Crimean Tatars have begun to come back to their homeland, and today over 200,000 of them live in the disputed peninsula. Unfortunately, the current conflict has them caught in the middle. As Ukraine and Russia seem poised to fight over Crimea, its original inhabitants can only stand by and watch and hope for a better future. I'm historian Faraz Al-Khatib with Marked in Time for Radio Islam. See you next week.
Allahu
Welcome back to Radio Islam. This is Malik Mujahid, your host, and you're listening to WCV 1450 AM as well as www.radioislam.com. And with me is Nahid Adhami and Ridwan Qadir, and we are talking about Kashmir. There are many, many causes in the world, and the causes are plenty. My friend this morning were meeting and they're talking about causes in our neighborhoods. Neighbors are denied wages and people are standing up fighting for their causes. So there are many causes. This was yesterday I wrote something about what's happening to Rohingya people in Burma, and 120,000 of them are without food. So there are several people working on that cause. What about if you're working on a cause, great. May God bless you. And if anything we can do, we will. Radio Islam is always happy to get you on air. And we talk about it. Although it's Radio Islam, but we don't talk theology here. We talk about peace and justice and neighborly relations. So it's a conversation among neighbors. And have Muslim guest and non-Muslim guest. And we don't use normally non-Muslim term. We say neighbors of other faith. So if you don't have a cause, maybe pick up the Kashmir cause. So what, Nahid, people could do for Kashmir?
First and foremost is working on how to bring peace to this region. This region was so peaceful. You know, when I left it in 1988, we used to be, travel in the middle of the night. There was no army, no guns, no, you know, fear of getting robbed or looted. And it was such a peaceful place.
So to achieve that goal, Kashmiris are demonstrating and some becoming militant in frustration to achieve their freedom. What people in Chicago can do?
I think we can somehow educate people here.
So education is first. So yeah. Learn about it. Just learn Google Kashmir. Are there a couple of websites just for information, which are current information? I remember somebody tweeted me, and it was a nice tweet. So I retweeted about Kashmir. Oh. And I sent them a message that if there is a website or something, I think there is Kashmir.info or something. Is there a website like that?
There's a greater Kashmir in...
There are several resources, but the largest circulating newspaper in Kashmir was recently banned.
Yeah.
And a veteran journalist was arrested for over 2 months without any cause, and he was released only recently.
So his paper is back on air or no?
No, it's not back on the air at all. And not only that, all the archives are gone too.
Which one are you talking
about? So I'm talking about Kashmir Reader. Okay. So...
also,
that was a huge resource, and it's been a blow to the whole journalism society.
So Kashmir Reader is gone,
right? And in Chicago, we have a new organization, a think tank called the Kashmir Society, that's emerging, and it's raising awareness in a thoughtful way, analytical way, not just in terms of protesting, but also how you educate yourself and how education, analysis, thoughtfulness, and leadership leads to peaceful solutions. So we'll be hearing more about it in the coming weeks. Yeah. We have two exhibits planned for February.
What is the website for that?
We don't have a website at this moment.
Oh, please don't announce things without a website. That's not illegal in this country, is it? Okay, so there, is there a website for Kashmir which we can tell people to check out
Kashmir,
and have information?
There is a website called Kashmir Monitor.
KashmirMonitor.com or .org?
No, .com. And
KashmirMonitor.com is not available.
It's not?
Yeah.
Maybe it's shut down too. Greater Kashmir.
What is Greater Kashmir?
It's a newspaper. It's been there forever.
Okay, so we'll be checking and letting you know where you can gather. GreaterKashmir.com, unfortunately, is also not a website. It seems the Indian government is knocking down these websites. So Greater Kashmir is not available.
We forgot to tell you that all the... cell phones and all the means of communication was shut down for all these months in Kashmir.
So tell us about the exhibit, because you see, Kashmir's story is not told. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go in masjid after masjid, rarely anybody prays for Kashmir even.
But
there is no newspaper, there is no information. There are so many newspapers, Urdu Times and this and that. Why not you write an article each week in there? Well, what is happening? Maybe you get information from Kashmir Monitor or Kashmir something, or the journalist whose newspaper is lost. Mm. Maybe he can write an article, we can publish here.
The Kashmir issue has been pressed underground for such a long time that it's difficult for people to relate to it without a coherent framework. So a couple of years ago, Muslim institutions in Chicago encouraged me to go around Islamic centers and talk about Kashmir. So there were about 24, 25 presentations I made raising the awareness about it within the Muslim community. Time and time again, Muslim leaders of Chicago told me that we have always heard that there's a Kashmir issue, but we don't know much beyond it. So that was an awareness. Now what the Kashmir Society is doing, having exhibits along with these presentations. So there will be one coming up in early February. Hopefully the weather will cooperate too. There's another one planned in downtown in March. We don't have a firmed up date yet, but you will be hearing about it.
What will be in that exhibit?
Exhibit will be a coherent picture, not just the atrocities, the human rights abuses, but what's leading up to that. Why is it that these things are not talked about in the general media, and how it all started, What are some of the possible solutions? Where do we go from there? What we can possibly do?
One of the things which I would like to suggest to our listeners, if you do have a cause of human rights, great. If you don't, maybe you can resolve this year to adopt Kashmir as a cause, and you can just simply Google it. Kashmir cause, what Kashmiris want, what Indians are doing in Kashmir. There got to be some information available, and then you can Google news. If news.google doesn't have any information of Kashmir, you call your local television and local newspaper. Hey, you talk about this thing and that situation, but there is nothing about Kashmir. Would you like to publish something? Would you like to meet some Kashmiris? Because newspapers, they try to see who is calling and what a purpose they are calling. This is one thing. Second thing, did your church ever had a program on Kashmir? Maybe you should invite some Kashmiris, and if you can contact Radio Islam, maybe we will connect you with some Kashmiris, or maybe if you're a mosque, you can make sure that at least in when you make prayers and dua, you include Kashmir also as one of that. Because you see, the dua is not only asking God, but it also reminding ourselves and our responsibility. So this could be another thing. So we just got 1 minute to go. So 30 second, I'll give it to you, Nahid, to say if you have a message in 30 seconds. Or shorter, and then I'll give you 30 seconds then, because we need to wrap it up.
My message to the listeners is that we live in this information technology age, and in this time, this should not be, my people in Kashmir should not be faced with such severity, 5 month shutdown, curfews, and the students lost almost 1 year of education. They cannot sit for exams.
So your message is for people to adopt Kashmir cause as one of the cause to understand and advocate for. What is your, I realize that we are running out of time. So just 10 seconds.
In 10 seconds, imagine peace. Say that again. Imagine peace.
Imagine
what
peace.
Peace will bring to that region. This is one-fifth of humanity we are talking about.
And three and nuclear powers around it.
And the road to peace. This has implications for the U.S. foreign policy. The road to peace in Afghanistan, go through Kashmir.
And learn about Kashmir by Googling it. Thank you so much, Nahid, for coming to our studio. And thank you so much, Ridwan, for it. Before you go, you should know that Radio Islam producer Olivia the Great Richardson is looking for interns. Send her your email at producer@radioislam.com. You have been listening to Radio Islam, a call-in talk show from 6 to 7 p.m. 7 days a week on WCV 1450 AM. Our producer is, of course, Olivia the Great Richardson. And our engineer today is Gus Royce. Thank you, Gus. And Olivia, Radio Islam is a Sound Vision Foundation production. The views expressed are the views of the host and the guests, not of the Sound Vision Foundation. I'm your host, Malik Mujahid, and join us tomorrow evening here for another great show at WCV 1450 AM, as well as www.radioislam.com. Peace. Salam. The bank.